So last time I sort of introduced some mathematical motivation for studying topological D-brains, namely the homological neurosymmetry conjecture. And so I explained the definition of the derived category of coherent sheaves which enters this conjecture and gave some idea about how the derived Foucault category is supposed to be defined, even though I didn't really get into details, which I don't understand anyway. So now, well, the reason I actually think there should be, well, a better definition of the Foucault category, more physically, well, motivated by physics, but I hope to get back to it later in these lectures. And so maybe it's a good idea to sort of outline the plan of the remaining lectures. So first I'd like to explain, to argue how this derived category of coherent sheaves arises in the physical approach to mirror symmetry. And also, it's interesting because physical approach also provides some, from physical viewpoint, certain facts about this derived category of coherent sheaves are obvious, and mathematically they're not at all obvious, and actually some are still, well, some are still not understood. So it's sort of the physical predictions of some mathematical theorems, which would be interesting to prove. And then I'll also talk about some recent work on D-brains in Landau-Ginzburg models, which are similar but much simpler than D-brains on Calabi-Yau manifolds. And that in that case, we can, it's even less explored mathematically, but actually seems easier. So I'll be able to write down some explicit formulas for this conjectured mathematical theorems. So and then I'll turn to A-brains and talk about what physics can say about the Foucault category. So then let me start with physical motivation for the homological mirror conjecture. So Kontsevich sort of proposed to enlarge sort of the A model to the this derived Foucault category, and to enlarge the B model to the bounded derived category of coherent sheaves. And a physically motivated way to enrich the A model and the B model is to, so what are A model and B model? They are two-dimensional topological field theories. And it's natural to, if you want to preserve more information, to also consider two-dimensional topological field theory with boundaries. So, and that leads to the notion of topological brain. So that is, if we consider the same physical theory, supersymmetric sigma model, but which is some two-dimensional field theory, but we consider it in a world sheet with boundaries. So say, well, this is sort of the incoming. So Fisher's strip. And now the boundaries of the strip, on these boundaries, the fields of the two-dimensional sigma model satisfy some boundary conditions. And if we want to work in the, if we want to perform topological twist, then we want to make sure that the boundary conditions preserve the Beresti symmetry. Then we can perform the twist even in the theory with boundaries. So I'll discuss in more detail the structure which emerges in this way later. That is, the structure which replaces topological field theory structure. So topological field theory, as you probably remember, is completely equivalent to supercommutative Frobenius algebra, and while this, that's without boundaries. While when you have boundaries, you have much more complicated structure, which was explored in the last few years only. But let me first explain then, let me outline how one can make the relation between, say, derived category and D-brains. So actually the first observation, I don't think we know yet how to prove that B-brains can be described by derived category completely, but let me at least explain why we think they're related. So first of all, I want to explain what the relation between objects is. So objects of this derived category, well, I'll focus on the B side for now, are complexes of coherent sheaves, and well, if you want a smooth manifold, might as well replace them by complexes of holomorphic vector bundles. It's general enough. So how do these things appear in the sigma model? Well, if you consider sigma model, supersymmetric sigma model, then the simplest kind of boundary condition you can impose is the Neumann boundary condition. That is, say, the bosonic fields, or the normal derivative of the bosonic field vanishes at the boundary. And that turns out to preserve B-type Bursty charge. So this gives us B-type boundary condition. And from the modern viewpoint, this just corresponds to a D-brain wrapping the whole manifold. So this condition doesn't constrain the endpoint of the string to lie anywhere. It can be anywhere. So we're just dealing with a D-brain wrapping the whole manifold on which our string propagates. And the fact that it's a just Neumann condition means that the gauge field in the brain is zero. So it's a it's natural to associate to this B-brain a trivial line bundle on our target space. And, well, which is, of course, an object of this, but it was an object of this category. And then Witten in 92, I think, showed how to generalize this. Namely, he showed that if you have any holomorphic vector bundle, then it gives a B-type boundary condition for B-brain. That is, more generally, so suppose we have a vector bundle with a connection such that the anti-holomorphic part of connection is flat, then the boundary condition is changed because we may have non-trivial curvature. So where F is a curvature.
Too many Fs. What is the X that gets differentiated in the normal direction?
So X is a map from, okay, maybe X was a bad choice. Okay. Actually, pretty bad choice. This is still X. Okay, so I have the field of the sigma model is a map from the world shape to X. Okay. So, and then the boundary condition is not Neumann anymore, it has a correction. And Witten showed that that's a, well, strictly speaking, also fermion terms here. We didn't show that this is a this choice of if the anti-holomorphic part of the curvature vanishes, then it's a supersymmetry preserving boundary condition, which essentially means that it's a B-type boundary condition. And he also showed, well, what about A model? Well, if you look at the A model, then this choice of boundary condition doesn't preserve A-type Bursty charge. On the other hand, so this is B-type boundary condition. Okay, so let me write in components. Yeah, I guess. So there is a Rorschach metric, sorry, target space metric, and well, this is a two-form in target space. It's a symmetric form in target space, and that's how the condition.
He is a line bundle.
Sorry?
He is a line bundle or a vector?
He is a line bundle for now. Okay, but And actually, Witten's rather sketchy on the case of vector bundles. But one can show that actually his argument goes through, and then there's a version of this which works for arbitrary vector bundles. To do it right, one has to introduce some degrees of freedom living on the boundary of the world shit, some extra stuff which lives here, which I don't think has been written up anywhere. But anyway, so that's it's possible to do. So, and on the for A-type boundary conditions, well, these are not so simple. That is, Neumann, for example, doesn't work. Neither does Dirichlet in all directions. But Witten showed that if you consider if you consider a Lagrangian submanifold, let Enabler be a vector bundle, well, Hermitian vector bundle actually, with a flat connection, then this gives an example, well, this can be used to construct an example of an A-type boundary condition. Okay. So this is all done on a classical level, and one may worry about possible anomalies, quantum anomalies. But, actually, in this case, there are none. And here, there may be quantum anomalies, which Witten doesn't address. So thus we see that at least this is the issue which I mentioned before. So if you consider this Lagrangian submanifold, without any topological restrictions, then first of all, there could be anomaly in the R charge. Remember, have this graded Lagrangian submanifolds and some topological constraint. And if it's not satisfied, you can have an anomaly of the R charge. It's pretty complicated. So it is. Actually, it was worked out by Kentaro. I guess it only appears in the book, which is still not published. So Kentaro worked out in detail how this happens. For this one, needs to study the index of the Dirac operator with boundaries. Kentaro showed that the condition of anomaly cancellation for the R charge is precisely the condition that the Maslow class vanishes. There's a further possible difficulty that on the quantum level, the BRST charge can have anomaly, which relates to this issue which actually Colin stressed last time, that this latest version of the definition of the Fourier category is not just graded Lagrangian submanifolds with some flat vector bundle. There is some further data which says that, you know, if you have anomaly in the BRST charge, you're supposed to deform this object in some infinity sense until the anomaly disappears. So it's sort of extra complication. Okay. So this is just to show that, that particular objects here and here are indeed B brains and A brains, as they're called. Okay. Now, later on, people constructed more general A brains and B brains. For example, for the B brain, one can consider arbitrary complex submanifold Y in X. And a triple, a complex submanifold Y of X is a holomorphic vector bundle on Y and Nabla, which means that Dalbar square is zero. And then one can associate to this triple a B-type boundary condition And so one can again show that particular objectless derived category is can be thought of as a B brain. Now, well, if you want to, well, one can do a similar thing for complex. So the next question is what can associate to complexes of holomorphic vector bundles? For simplicity, it's much simpler if you just think about Zmod 2 graded complexes. So there is, I'll have one vector bundle and another vector bundle, which are both holomorphic, and some morphisms such that composition in either direction is zero. So so that's sort of an object of the derived category folded modulo 2. So what can we associate to, well, so why is this a boundary? Why is this a B brain? How can I think about it as a B brain? Well, it turns out that one can construct more general B brains, and allows both brains and anti-brains. Okay. So so E naught is basically the bundle on the some brain and E1 on the anti-brains. And it's perfectly legal just to set F and G to, well, the situation when both F and G are zero, this corresponds to boundary condition when you just have brain and anti-brain, some vector bundles, and no, they're not talking to each other. So on the other hand, when F and G are non-zero, then this corresponds to a boundary condition for the sigma model where the boundary tachyon is turned on. So the, because of the reverse GSO projection on strings which connect this brain to this brain, well, there's a tachyon mode, and the action in the presence of the tachyon mode of the tachyon can be written in superspace. So the, let me write the path integral for the sigma model. So have the integral over the maps from sigma to x, and also some fermions. There is the bulk action, and then there is a trace of the holonomy operator, which I'll write as a trace of P exponential. The way this is like to write it, and this is a super trace. So what are these objects here? Well, this is sort of super connection, and which depends on a super field. And the super field, capital phi I, I here, to be compatible with the previous notation. So phi I is, well, the lowest component is just the power map, and then the super partner is some of the fermions. So while the superconnection combines both the gauge fields and the tachyon on the brain. So the diagonal pieces are the connections on the brain and the anti-brain, and then the off-diagonal pieces are the tachyons. Well, I guess we'll put the fullback connection. So, I guess it's better to write like this. There's some connection, Rorschach connection. I guess A is bad, too many A's. So. And of the diagonal is the tachyon fields. And the Taikon field, the Taikon field, basically F plus G dagger. So it's also a superfield, so it depends on this phi. So that's the boundary action. Or if you wish, boundary factor in the path integral. And it's constructed using this, using the gauge fields on the brains and the tachyon. And for supersymmetry, if you want to preserve this B-type supersymmetry, that is Bersty symmetry, you want T to be the sum of two things, such that F is holomorphic map and G is anti-holomorphic. And the condition of supersymmetry further restricts F and G to satisfy this. So therefore, situation we have brains, anti-brains, and tachyon turned on, plus Bersty symmetry. Well, just consider super variations. Well, one just writes down boundary conditions. Well, you just write down. Well, easiest to do when you're dealing with rank one bundles, but you can also do it for higher rank. Just because it's not coming in this form because you have this p exponential. Okay. It's much easier. So if you just have rank, well, it's better to get rid of it. So for this, one needs to introduce some boundary degrees of freedom, which describe, say, this bundle, and also one introduces a boundary fermion, which comes with a super trace. Okay. And then one gets a local action, local boundary action, and then you need to figure out the super variation of everything, okay, such that under this n equals 2 supersymmetry. So it's a non-trivial exercise, actually. Okay. Relatively, well, especially when you have higher rank gauge fields. And also not written up anywhere. So for rank one case, you can look up our paper with Yi Li, where at least we do the rank one explicitly in presence of tachyon. Okay. So actually, I mean, other places as well. Yeah, the case of rank one is worked out in some places, in several places, but higher rank hasn't been done right in general. So there are some special cases when, again, like actually, Kentaro used this some special case of this formalism, namely when the bundles have rank 2 to the power n, you can use boundary fermions to realize everything. So sadly, when the bundle doesn't have this power 2 to the n, you need to use some boundary degrees of freedom which live in some homogeneous space or whatever. Or you need to pull some projections, so that hasn't been done for arbitrary rank yet. Oh yeah, sure. Right. Yeah, yeah. That's the main special case you can do.
Manifestly.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. The main special case you can do, like some. Yeah. We can actually always do with fermions, but then you need to impose project boundary fermions. Then you need to impose some projections. That's also a possible approach, right? So. Okay. So well, yeah. So if the bundle is an exterior power of anything, you can do it easily, right? So, but in general, it's not so easy. Okay, so anyway, the net result is that you can satisfy supersymmetry provided F and G satisfy this. So therefore, this Z-mod 2 graded complex does have a natural realization string theory, simply the brain anti-brain system with tachyons turned on. Okay. Now, therefore, at least objects do seem to match something here. Okay. And then, of course, next question is, well, we don't really know how many B-type boundary conditions there are, but this seems like a general, rather general case. And then next question is whether the morphisms match. That is, so first of all, what is the physical description of morphism, and why do these boundary conditions form a category at all? Now this has to do with So I prefer to think about Z-mod 2 graded ones. Just think about bosons and fermions rather than the whole U1 charge. So easier. Right. So, well, so you could say that I just.
But the thing I just described was that particular.
Yeah. So I prefer just.
The only construction I know that works for Z.
So basically, I'm not keeping track of R charge in these lectures. I'm never going to keep track of who is boson and who is a fermion. So everything's going to be Z mod 2 graded. Okay. So, okay. So, well, so what are then spaces of, first of all, what are spaces of morphism? And then we ask how to compose them from the physical viewpoint. Well, if you have a brain, say, M and brain N, so there are two boundary conditions for a string. So you can quantize the string on an interval with these boundary conditions, and this provides some vector space HMN, which you want to interpret as space of morphism between M and N. Well, strings are oriented, so there's some sense of direction here. So if you just look at the special cases that I described above, so can we check that actually this space is the space of morphism in the derived category, at least on the B side? Well, for vector bundles, so if M, N are vector bundles, then this vector space is shown by Witten to be the cohomology, double cohomology. Because one in vector bundles, which it does indeed match the space of morphism, well, many stars. Space of morphism in the derived category. Now, for other examples of B-type boundary conditions, this check hasn't been performed until recently. Even for simplest case, like complex, well, there's some submanifold in a complex submanifold in the Calabi-Yau or some vector bundle in the complex submanifold. So recently there was some work by Eric Sharp and Sheldon Katz, and I guess there's some several papers. So there's some papers. Tony participated, and also Calderaro, I think, in some cases. And they checked that, they computed the space, so they performed this quantization for more complicated boundary conditions and verified that indeed one gets these X groups which appear in the derived category. Okay. That's not so obvious a priori because the recipe for computing X groups is rather complicated. The cases they considered were basically complex submanifolds with some vector bundles on them. And versions with B field, which I haven't discussed at all. Now, the most general case, in some sense, this complex of vector bundles, would be of most interest. But there, the checks haven't been performed yet. Okay, so the spaces of morphisms also seem to match, at least in special cases, although in general, we don't know yet. The issue is just whether the spectral sequence which computes the X is realized physically. And in some special cases, these guys showed that it is. Okay. Now, therefore I'll take this, that I think this is a sign that this, we can identify simply the, So we have objects and morphisms, and then already on the physical side, and then the question is why can we compose morphisms from the physical viewpoint. We need to think about more about what it means to have a topological field theory with boundaries. So recall that in closed, if you consider topological field theory without boundaries, we have a similar situation. We'll have circle as our space, and when you quantize, we're going to get some vector space. There's only one in that case, without any indices, if you consider some sort of string worldship, which has several, which is oriented somehow, let's see. And then we have, say, three incoming circles in this case and two outgoing one. And then a string path integral and topological field theory, well, topological field theory path integral is supposed to associate to this diagram a map from, in this case, three copies, tensor product of three copies of H into two copies of H, okay? So that's what topological field theory does. And in this case, we can reduce, well, in principle, there are many such manifolds, and the number of circles are restricted. But since any two-dimensional manifold like this can be glued from few basic pieces, like this one, and this one. So basically, all we have to do is to specify the rules for this basic one, and then we can associate something well-defined for every manifold, and let's see what happens there. So, well, here we have a to this we can must associate a map like this. So it's some sort of multiplication, and then consistency conditions require that this is actually associative multiplication. So this corresponds to a map from H to C, sort of a trace map, and this corresponds to a map from C to H, that's identity. So therefore, topological field theory can be described just by specifying some vector space H with some multiplication trace and the identity. Okay. So, and then you can compute arbitrary amplitudes in topological field theory without boundaries. So closed one for now.
The closed model
here. Right, yeah.
Okay.
So now let's do the open string case. Open, well, not really string. Topological field theory with boundaries. So, okay. Well, there we have more possibilities for now. So we have intervals with all possible boundary conditions. We also have circles still with a single vector space. And then the Borel-Schmitt have more complicated shape. So we can have things like that. Okay. And for every such diagram, we are supposed to associate some linear map from the tensor product of, well, several copies of H and several copies of this HMN. So, there are two kinds of boundaries. So it's a manifold with corners, as you can see. And so there are two kinds of boundaries. These are the sort of incoming boundaries, and these are propagating boundaries. And on the propagating boundaries, the type of the boundary condition cannot change. So it's just n here, maybe some k here, l here, and so. Okay. So we have more complicated diagrams, but we're still supposed to associate a linear map from tensor product of HMN, HNK, HKL, and H into this tensor product. So again, so what are the, well, we can draw the basic building blocks of this. So then we know what that data are required. So, well, we still have those building blocks, of course, plus the open string version. So we have this diagram, for example. And the linear map associated to it is a map from HMN to HNK to HMK. So, and that's why we can compose elements of these vector spaces. That's how we get category, because the topological field theory with boundaries requires, well, in particular specifies the composition law. And one can think of it in some dual way. You can think of elements of this vector spaces as boundary, well, as people say, boundary changing operators. And then this composition is just composition law of boundary changing operators. And that's probably the best way to compute these compositions. And actually, well, in some cases, you can easily see that, say, composition law for this vector space is precisely the same one as in the derived category. Okay. So, which gives an extra justification for the fact, well, now we know that B-brains form a category just because they come from a topological field theory, and then there's a good evidence that this category is actually the same, it's equivalent to the derived category of coherent sheaves. So this is sort of the main evidence, well, it's outlined roughly the evidence that the B-brains are described by derived category of coherent sheaves. That means that the vector spaces of open strings are the spaces of morphism, while composition of boundary changing operators is the composition of morphisms.
I mean, you've only sort of told us what the HMNs are at best for, you know, coherent in the objects in the category of coherent sheaves, let's say. Right? But you haven't really.
No, morphisms are.
HMNs are for complexes.
And no, morphisms are not morphisms in the category of coherent sheaves.
And you've told us what the morphisms are for, say, Sharp et al.'s result for that case where the coherent sheaf is a vector bundle on some complex submanifold. I mean, I'm sure this is enough information to really deduce that.
The compositions are the same? You worried about compositions?
No, that the morphisms are the same.
I don't know that they're the same.
Exactly.
No, that's a different issue. You can just compute the spaces, okay, and verify that they are the same space obtained by inverting quasi-isomorphisms. These X groups are only obtained if you consider the derived category, not the category of coherent sheaves. Okay. That's a proof by example. So in some particular, you can think about the coherent sheaves as some objects of the coherent sheaves are just examples of objects of the derived category, but morphisms are different. And actually, in examples, the spaces HMN, which string theory gives, are not morphisms in the category of coherent sheaves, but in the derived category. So the most general case has not been considered, namely the complex of vector bundles. Like, even if it's checked, question remains. Like, if I take a complex submanifold, right, I can think of it as a complex submanifold, or I can write down resolution, say, in terms of vector bundles, right? It's not at all clear physically why computing in two different ways should give the same answer, right? In one case, I have this brain antibrain pair with some tachyon. In another case, I have a totally different boundary condition, and it's not obvious that they should give the same result. So that sort of difficulty always remains. So I'm not saying we can prove anything here. Okay. This is just evidence that you can say that the category of B brains is the same as category this derived category of coherent sheaves. Okay. Well, roughly speaking, the argument is this, which I'm not sure how to make precise. You can say that. So suppose I have a brain antibrain pair with some tachyon fields turned on, right? So the argument is roughly the following, that this space is HMN, I compute in topologically twisted theory. So of course it do not depend whether we compute in the ultraviolet or the infrared. Okay, if you compute in the infrared, it's supposed to flow first and then brain's annihilated, then left with something more complex. Sorry? But tachyon is not a No. When I turn on the tachyon, it's a relevant perturbation. So we have some boundary flow. So I'm just saying that you can compute either in the ultraviolet or in the infrared, right? So in the ultraviolet, you just work with these tachyon fields, you know, don't worry about anything, right? And then you get some result, which, so you get a complex of vector bundles, say, and you just get some special sequence, which describes this morphism in the right category, right? Then in principle, you could also say, I could have just flowed to the infrared and then I get to say left with some complex submanifold, right? Right. So that leads to superficially totally different computation.
Sorry, how do you have so much about
we don't. I'm just saying that that's where the physical assumption is.
You imagine that they flow into the
other. Yeah, one imagines that the resolution flows to some complex submanifold which the resolution, okay? So I would never be able to prove that, of course. So that's where the problem is, right? But if the flow indeed flows where it's supposed to be, then it's not surprising that you get the same results because it's a topological field theory. You compute either UV description or IR description. Okay. So, okay. Now, but let's assume that, okay, now we believe that the direct category is the same as category of deep brains. And then there are all kinds of interesting.
Okay. Is this something like a formality map? Are you saying that you can start with a complex and somehow deform it with cohomology? Is that what you're talking about?
In the sense, no, wait a second. So, no. Well, which cohomology? I mean, like shift, in the sense of shifts?
Yeah. You should be able to deform it to something quasi-isomorphic.
Right. Yeah, it's not very obvious, sure. Yeah.
No, but I'm assuming that the homology of your complex are quasi isomorphic.
No,
right.
No.
Why do you
no.
justify in the boundary field theory is that the renormalization through the flow of the tachyon takes the tachyon to infinity wherever it's not an isomorphism? That's what I mean. Local model.
Okay, but then this just says that. No, it just says that it deforms to something with the same cohomology. It doesn't say that it deforms to the cohomology.
Okay.
Yeah.
One thing I'm sure about is that F and G flow to infinity when they are isomorphisms in the places in the manifold that are isomorphisms when they're not.
So there's a hole here. We can't really have a hope to prove, probably. But we can just assume it and draw some interesting mathematical consequences, physical predictions, if you wish. So, one can try to, sort of give an argument or some evidence that the identification is correct just by checking that axioms, but we know a priori that this category of, topological field theory with boundaries are Bayes' axioms just by construction. Like it's constructed by path integral. And then it actually imposes a bunch of constraints on this data, the vector spaces HMN, and also H, in various compositions. Now we can check whether they're really satisfied for the derived category. Okay. So that provides some extra evidence. But actually, we'll see at least some non-trivial statements about the derived category, which I actually don't know how to check. So they're not obviously nonsense. And probably correct, but I wasn't able to check them. So what are the? Some of the things are easy to check. Namely, I already mentioned that in the category of B brains, is some symmetry for the spaces. Namely, there's some natural duality relation like this. Okay. And I can see this, there's a pairing, natural pairing between spaces of morphism going in the opposite direction. And this pairing is simply given by this diagram. Uh, So we start with H cross H, and then you end up with an empty manifold. So associate C to it, so there should be some linear map like this. And it's easy to check that it's non degenerate. So this is a non degenerate pairing, so the spaces are isomorphic. Well, H minus is isomorphic to the dual space. Well, of course, for a general category that does not hold, so it's an interesting check whether it holds for the derived category of coherent sheaves. Well, it can construct the inverse. I mean, it can think of it this way. See, here's a map from MN to the dual. Okay. And then the inverse is given by the decomposing these two strips, just like in the closed string case. So there you have a metric like this, right? So of course, if you take general manifold X, yeah, right. Okay, sorry. Right. That's true. Right. Okay, sorry.
So is this now a Calabi-Yau statement?
Right. So, of course, for general axis doesn't hold, but by serduality it does hold for Calabi-Yaus. Which is not surprising because we didn't have topological field theory just for any complex manifold, just for Calabi-Yau. Okay. Now, so that's good. So what's the next piece of data we have? There's this diagram. Okay. There's a linear map from A, from like this. So how do we interpret it in terms of derived category? So first of all, well, one can easily see that, well, from the axioms, and that this map actually defines structure of a module. That is, so H is an algebra, and actually HMN is module over H for any pairs MN. Okay. So what is this? Well, first of all, we need to understand what is H from the mathematical viewpoint. So for Calabi-Yau, as you remember, we have, well, we already know what H is supposed to be. So, but it's not at all obvious why this vector space is supposed to act on this one. HMN was supposed to be space of morphisms in the derived category. Okay. So, what is the natural action of this space on this one? Well, these are actually both Z-mod 2 graded vector spaces in my convention, so it should be a graded action. It's a Z-mod 2 graded module over this Z-mod 2 graded algebra. So, actually the way to see why it's this, why it works like this is actually implicit in this paper of the talk of Kantsevich in 1994. He basically interpreted closed strings in terms of open strings, okay? And there's a very brief paragraph in this talk that which says the following. The paper is about how to extract the B model from the category of B brains, or the derived category in his situation. So he says that this vector space should be thought of as a Hochschild cohomology of this category of B brains, derived category. So he doesn't explain what it is, but he says, well, one definition which works in this case is the following. If you consider X cross X, then we can consider the diagonal in this space, okay, and it's obviously a complex submanifold. You can think about the submanifold as representing the identity functor in this derived category. And well, it's a complex submanifold, so it also can consider you can regard it as a brain and consider its endomorphisms, morphisms from this brain to itself. Okay. And then it's a theorem that, well, consider a big reading. So you get all this. Homology like this. So
that's a vector space. Are you saying that's an isomorphism
as algebras? As algebras, I think. As algebras, I think. No? Let's see. It's supposed to be more.
That's the Pogrebnikov who we. It's not an algebra.
One second. This is how a natural map, like this.
It is a natural map.
Well, just like working everywhere mode 2 in any case. But why is it not? Okay, let me just continue. So, now there is a natural map like this, though. Okay. And for any pair.
Natural map like that, given the description on the left-hand side.
Also on the right-hand side.
No,
that's what you're trying to show us.
That's not an. It's important that that's not an algebra.
But nevertheless, there is a natural map like this for the following. Sorry?
For the left hand side.
Yeah.
Given the description in terms of X, delta delta, there's a natural map.
Yeah, so you mean the left hand side? Sorry. I thought you meant talking about that left hand side. Yeah, sure. Okay, so so you have this, take vector space. This vector space acts on H and N. And the reason is very simple. It's actually easy to explain. Well, it's easy to explain when X is an affine manifold. And the reason, X is an affine manifold because then this you can think of. You can think of algebraically about this vector space as X of the algebra A of holomorphic functions on X regarded as a bimodule. Well, regarded as a module over A tensor A. Now, if you have element in here, then we have element, say, little h. This vector space then I can think of it as a morphism from A to A, regarded as an object with derived category here. Now, if I have a module M over A, which is which can be thought of as an object of the derived category, right? So H can be thought of as a so we have a module M and some endomorphism of this module phi. Let's see. In the derived category of module A modules, what did you consider? Sorry, in general. Then we can tensor these two maps and get something like this, and this leads to a map from M to a different map H tensor, well, H composed with phi from M to N in the sense of the derived category. So this is a natural action of this vector space, or this algebra actually, on all the vector spaces H, M, N. Now I'm a bit puzzled by this. What you said, that this algebra struct, natural algebra structure here is not the same as
the structures are different. You have to multiply by the K class to actually make the algebra structure.
I see. So I don't understand then what the interpretation is. But okay, so the point is that there is a natural action. So I would like then to interpret. Sorry? Sorry, there is a what? Oh, I see. I see. I see.
Yeah, on the level of chunky algebras, it's going to
I see. I see. Okay, thank you. Now, so there's some action. And in particular, there is a, well, special case of it. It was at M equals to N. So we can consider a diagram like that. So that's a map from H to HMN, or MM, sorry. It's called the bulk boundary map. And this map, well, you can think of this map, let's say alpha, alpha M. This map can be thought of as a, well, let me call this map also something. This map is obtained by restricting M to a particular situation, namely when the incoming element here is identity. Well, M is equal to N, and the incoming element is identity. So these are called bulk boundary maps, and there's a very interesting further condition called the Cardy condition, which I'm not sure how to which is not obvious that it's satisfied, but it should be satisfied even if indeed the category of B-brains is equal to the derived category.
It's satisfied, actually.
Okay, I'll just write it down, and then So, well, the point is that consider X. Mn. It's called V. Say. So V is a vector space of morphisms, and it's a left module over and the morphisms of M in the derived category and the right module of endomorphisms of N. And it follows from considering diagram like that. So the left action by XMM and then right by X10N. And then, interesting question is what is the I'll call this map. Well, suppose I have, say, is like, say, F1 and F2, say. So then I have this linear map, which can call, say, capital F of F1, F2 from V to V. And the Cauchy condition says that the supertrace of this map, so I remind that V is a graded vector space, so you can take about supertrace. So the supertrace can be expressed with this bulk boundary maps alpha M. So namely, what to compute supertrace, we need to sew this end with this one. So we get something like this. I should draw it better. Where this insertion corresponds to F1 and this one to F2. On the other hand, we can look at this diagram slightly differently. We can imagine that in this diagram, and that's F1, that's F2. And this is just equal to the inner product in the closed string metric of the bulk state. The dual one. And there is a dual product, dual map from HMM to H. Okay. So therefore, the supertrace, that's supposed to be supertrace. F, and that's supposed to be equal to the product in the bulk in the closed string sector of these two bulk states. Now I'm not sure. Well, I'm not sure what did Caldera prove. He proved precisely that. So in the special case when both F1 and F2 are identities, that seems to be just some version of Grothendieck Riemann-Roch theorem.
It's Grothendieck Riemann-Roch always, but it's hard to, I mean, it reduces eventually to Grothendieck Riemann-Roch, but you have to work through it.
I see. Yeah, because in general, for F1 and F2 not equal to identities, it doesn't compute the Euler characteristic, say, of V.
Yeah.
It can be some super trace or whatever, so I'm not sure how it's related to Grothendieck Riemann-Roch. Whatever. So in particular, the simple version of this, for example, would be to take to take M and N. So the vector bundles, homomorphic vector bundles. Okay. And then F1 and F2 live in respectively and the homologies of endomorphism bundles of M and N respectively. And then the, well, so they, well, they use some, well, they use some maps on the cohomologies, double cohomologies of M star tensor N. And then the Cardi says that this supertrace of this map is computed in terms of something, these guys, associated to F1 and F2. Okay. So, and if F1 is set to an F2 identity, that just presumably the Chern, well, this guy becomes a Chern class, but in general, it's not Chern characters. So in general, it's not clear to me how to write this out. You know. One is to define these guys mathematically, which presumably is still unpublished work of Calderaro. Sorry, Grothendieck Riemann Rock just for I meant the Grothendieck Riemann Rock, which computes just Euler characteristic of this space.
Here's the book.
Well, I'm not sure. Yeah, I guess. Yeah, here's the book. Yeah. Right. So, okay. So the fact that we believe that derived category is equivalent to the category of B brains means that this should be automatic. And that's an interesting result, which, as I just heard, was proved.
Can I ask, once we have topological field theories, you can start looking at patterns of topological field theories. And if you have such a nice that one could get access to the field boundary.
Yeah, I don't understand. I don't understand how to deform. Well, there's a different. I don't know what the analog of, say, Frobenius manifold is in the presence of brains. So that's what I meant, like some analog of this. This is the analog of Frobenius algebra, right? I don't know what the analog of Frobenius manifold is. Now, that's sort of complicated. Well, so this, it seems like the derived category of coherent sheaves provides some rather complicated realization of the axioms, rather simple axioms of topological field theory with boundaries. And I would like to present another much simpler realization, which I don't think has been explored mathematically at all. This has to do with Landau-Ginzburg models. So it's kind of similar to what we said was going on before, so except that now X is going to be just a fine space. Now, we want some sort of, well, that's not a good situation, but we can sort of enforce compactness by going from sigma models with target X to Landau-Ginzburg models. That basically means that, well, so now we have an extra piece of data, a holomorphic function W called the superpotential. And it's holomorphic because we want to preserve n equals 2 supersymmetry on the world sheet. But of course, we killed n equals 2 superconformal symmetry. Now, the situation is simpler just because there's no non-trivial geometry here, as it seems. Everything is encoded just in this superpotential W. And various, well, computations are much simpler. For example, we can still perform the B twist. So we take this n equals 2 on Landau-Ginzburg model, which is deformation of sigma model by the superpotential, and then it still has a B model. There's no A model here, unlike in the previous case, because, there's just no conserved charge could be used to twist to get the A model. So if you're talking about closed string, it's very easy to figure out what the spectrum of the topological closed string is. So this circle, still this one, to which we associate vector space H. And what's H here? Well, H is just, can be thought of as a chiral ring of this theory. And H, in this case, is simply algebra of functions on our space X modulo the ideal generated by derivatives of W. Well, that's very simple. It's called the Jacobi ring. Now, what about D-brains? Well, D-brains are somewhat more complicated. So these D-brains were first studied by Kentaro and Wafa and Iqbal in a very nice detailed paper. And they show that if you consider ordinary kind of boundary conditions, that is, submanifolds with gauge fields, and they're very constrained when you turn on the superpotential. In particular, the superpotential must be constant along all the submanifolds. So in general, the typical case is when W is equal to x to the n. That means that the only thing you can do is to consider submanifold given by x equals, given by a point. That's the only submanifold where W is constant. Also, Kentaro showed later that actually if you put a brain anywhere except x equals to zero, then there is a spontaneous breaking of Beresteyn symmetry. So actually, the spectrum of the closed string states is empty. Really, there's only one choice for this geometric brain, x equals to zero. Okay. On the other hand, we expect actually to see more structure here than just a single zero brain. We expect to see many brains, B brains. And then to distinguish between them, it's better to use this description in terms of boundary tachyons rather than geometric in terms of submanifolds. So if you write out the same action I wrote before for the sigma model, that is the action which depends on the two gauge fields in the tachyon, and imposes this Beresteyn symmetry, leads to some constraints. And the constraints, some of them are the same as before, namely that the bundles are holomorphic. However, it turns out that the constraint on the tachyon is somewhat different. Again, tachyon must be equal to F plus G dagger, where F and G are both holomorphic maps between our pair of holomorphic vector bundles. But instead of requiring that F times G be zero, and also G times F, one gets the condition that F times G is equal to W times identity plus a constant. So one does not get a complex here, but some sort of twisted complex. So what happens basically is that F and G are components of the Beresteyn operator on the boundary. So the Beresteyn operator on the boundary, which we call B, some form like this. So in the obvious notation, sort of. Acts like this. So it acts on sections. Acts on sections of its bundles. And the square of this guy is not zero. It's equal, must be equal to this. And the reason is that there's also a bulk contribution to the square of the Beresteyn charge, and they just want to cancel that. And that bulk contribution is just given by this. So minus that. So that's to find, at least this kind of, we can start with a large class of B-type boundary conditions for this model where there is superpotential sort of trivial target space. They are described not by a complex of vector bundles, but by a twisted complex, where the twist is given by the superpotential. So in a sense, it makes the problem of finding, constructing B-brains for Landau-Ginzburg models very simple. One starts with some function, which is usually polynomial in applications, and then just looks for these two maps like this. This product in the direction is W plus a constant. And in case when, well, our space is just CN, so this is just rectangular matrices with polynomial entries. So we just need to, well, actually, you can easily see that if you want to satisfy both of these, then rank of V0 and rank of V1 must be the same. So F and G actually square matrices. So then the problem of finding boundary conditions basically reduces to finding a way to factorize superpotential into matrix polynomials. Well, there are also connections here, which must be taken into account, but on a trivial space like that, you can always gauge them away by gauge transformations. So basically, you can set, might as well set the connections to be trivial. And all information about B-brains is encoded in this matrix factorization. Well, once we understand B-brains, one needs to understand, we'd like to then be able to compute morphisms between them. In other words, spectra of open strings and also their compositions, that is, boundary OPE algebra, if you wish, and also have the rest of the data related to topological field theory with boundaries. Namely, I would like to have this bulk boundary maps and also the action of the space of this space on the spaces of morphism between brains. And then finally, one anticipates that one has some sort of Cardi condition, which is satisfied still. And then one expects that the Cardi condition is some version of Riemann-Roch theorem for this situation. We said that the arguments of Calderaro are sort of general nature, so maybe it applies also to this case. Yeah, that's actually an interesting issue. So we expect also this analog of Serre duality here. And I'll write down explicitly the formula for the inner product, which is supposed to be non-degenerate. And space here is non-compact, but some compactness is ensured by the fact that the superpotential, which grows at infinity. So I don't know why the product that I will write down is non-degenerate. So it's an interesting problem. Problem where? Difficult to do what? To check non-degeneracy?
Are you making a distinction between
H
and
no? Well, in the same simple case, it's kind of trivial. You can check everything, indeed. Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah, so the interesting case is non-semi-simple, of course, like going to the superpotential. And that's where I don't know how to prove it. Of course, for semi-simple case, we can write down all the B-brains explicitly and check the degeneracy. Actually, Kentaro did this before. So the interesting case is this one. So next time I'll explain how to compute this spaces of morphisms for in this category. And we'll see that all this data are realized very simply. You can get twist formulas for everything. And one gets some, and the results can be interpreted as derived category of something. Also, and an interesting question, well, I also try to compare this, compare this with the result of the boundary CFT approach, because if the potential is homogeneous or quasi-homogeneous, then there's not only this UV description of the Rothschild theory, there's also this IR description in terms of the conformal field theory, and then one can try to construct brains there using boundary state formalism and then compute at least some of this data. And it's an interesting check, actually, on this, to understand the RG flow, to see that one gets the same results. So, in general, for Calabi-Yau, it's very hard, but here we can actually have some checks. Okay.